Hello, and welcome to Shattered Lives, an informed, conversational, cutting-edge radio show in touch with today's issues that impact the lives of crime victims, addressing the aftermath of crime, forging a path for hope, building awareness, and empowering listeners for the future. This is Donna Argor, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, with my co-host Delilah Jones, president of ImaginePublicity.com, welcoming you to today's show and to our library of weekly archive shows. It is our goal to make a difference. And yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to our special edition at the end of August for another cutting-edge show on a very special topic. We're coming to you on a Monday evening, and we're hoping that you'll join us live or on the archives, as always. We have a very unique kind of a show because the way our guest chooses to impart her message about the loss of a loved one is very unique indeed. And that's part of what attracted me to try to help build awareness, as always. So before we bring on Dr. Maggie Zingman, the mother of Brittany Phillips, I will say good evening to Delilah. How are you?
Doing fine, Donna. Thank you. And I'm so pleased to be on another show with Maggie Zingman. This is such an important issue that she's going to give information to our listeners. And, you know, the last, 13 years, I think, it has been just horrendous for her. And she has done such an amazing job of taking the tragedy that she's lived through and making an issue out of it and actually really getting out there, hands on, boots on the ground, and getting things done. I really commend her. I've known her for a long time and I love her dearly. So our hope is that some national news service would pick this story up and do something with it, not only just for Maggie's benefit and Brittany's benefit, but to benefit many, many other people out there who are in the same situation and have similar cases who could be solved because of DNA collection. So I don't want to give away the whole show, so I'm going to turn it back to you, Donna.
Well, that's okay. I mean, we're very enthused to have this. So, Dr. Maggie Zingman, welcome to Shattered Lives and welcome to our family of radio shows. It's such a pleasure to have you on.
Well, it's a pleasure for me to be able to talk with you and Delilah. I mean, you give a voice to so many silenced voices that, like Delilah said, I've known her for years. She found me driving out on the road somewhere, and we've connected ever since. But without shows like yours, you know, it's very hard to get the story out there.
Well, yeah, and I think that's part of the problem. So we have to use as many mediums as we can, from holding up signs on the edge of the road to doing this caravan like you do, to doing for missing persons, we do on the road to remember tour. There's many permutations, but I don't know. I wanted to ask you, is your caravan for justice, are you the only person that you know of that brings your message in quite the way that you do?
As far as I know, in the last, I guess I've been doing it for about 10 years, and I have yet to meet anybody else who's driven. I think now I've driven 180,000 miles through 48 states to get her story and to get the need for law change out there. So I have yet to meet anybody else out there. I would love to find out if other people are doing it, but I have yet to hear of that.
Well, I think that makes you a pioneer, you know?
I've always wanted to be a pioneer.
Well, yeah, that's true. And you know, does it, as a mother, as a psychologist, does it, over all of these years, has it gotten easier to talk about your daughter and the circumstances of her death, or is it harder? Does it increase? I mean, how do you feel about it now in 2017 versus 2004 or 5 or 6?
Well, I learned pretty much almost right away that I had to leave the psychologist at the door because nothing taught me about how to deal with losing a child. And it really doesn't go away. It changes into something different. I mean, I can still cry about it. I look at her pictures every day because they're all over my car. On one hand, it's easier to talk about it, but each year that it remains unsolved, that creates, the hole that starts filling up ends up, opening up again. But what always, and it's why I keep on traveling, part of just people's reactions to me on the highway at a rest stop. And when I go, I always visit cities and I'm in the city center usually. I mean, those are the things. I've had gifts, just emotional gifts from people over these last 13 years that, although I take my daughter back in a minute, they're just unbelievable. The people across the U.S. have just been so welcoming and so caring that it gives me a way to carry it.
Yeah, I can imagine, like, on the road, like Charles Kowalt or someone. Are you keeping, like, a journal or a diary when you're driving across country?
Yeah, I've been keeping a journal. And I usually document it on my website and on Facebook. I'll post all the stories and I keep a collection of the stories, which gets a little bit hard because I've had 165 stories now that I've had since 2007. But each one is so special, and I've been loosely writing a book, but I've never gotten anywhere where I could even start thinking about publishing it. But I keep, a record and just it's hard to forget everything. I mean, everywhere I go, there's something that even triggers a memory of Brittany or just the experience, just has a place in my mind that it's very hard to forget. And I don't want to forget it.
Oh, of course not. And, as a person who used to work in healthcare and someone that works in human services, I find it very interesting that you would say that, you had to put the psychology role, kind of at the door because your profession did not really prepare you for this. Do you feel now in meeting all of these families that have had unsolved homicides or the like, that's the commonality that even if they've had this loss, they really search for someone in terms of a therapist or someone to actually be able to connect with on a meaningful level? Have you collected those kinds?
Yeah, and I had to put it behind because I really had to learn a lot. I mean, when I was first notified, all I could think of was, who do I call? I don't want to wake up my parents. I don't want to wake up my best friend who lives in Tulsa who would have to come up. You don't think correctly. And then the way I was notified, they just said, are you Maggie Zingman? You need to call Tulsa Police. Your daughter's been murdered. All those things I didn't know how to deal with. What I learned soon on after, 4 or 5 months is that as I became an advocate for all the mistakes that happened with me, that was part of the healing process, which I understood as a psychologist because I'm a trauma psychologist, but I wasn't prepared for being jealous when somebody else's murder got solved. I just wasn't prepared for a lot of those things. I wasn't prepared for not being allowed to see my daughter. So I've learned about how the voice is more part of healing, which I always knew. And, I've also learned because people, when you fall into it, even people were starting to tell me, we'll do this and you'll find it. I've learned that, you don't necessarily have to have gone through it to help somebody, because sometimes somebody just saying to me, I can't imagine what you went through, is such a unbelievable statement because they are imagining in a way, that it's broadened it. But, when you get the notice that you've lost anybody, but especially a child, that loss of expectations just puts you in a shock, no matter if you're a doctor, a psychologist, or, you know, stay-at-home mom. You just can't think logically for a while. So that's sort of what I mean. But yes, you know, because of so many families I've met who they'll say, you know, well, we just gave up because our detective, you know, just sort of wasn't doing much. It's those people where they get a voice, you can really see the healing, and why I'm really stressing on people, you know, to reach out to me when I'm in the cities. You know, I try to do it through the website and Facebook, because feeling part of this family that none of us chose really does help part of the healing, which is going to be a lifelong process.
So. Oh, definitely, yeah. So just so that we understand a little bit, and then we can, I mean, the process of what you're actually doing, and then we can, you know, get into the more of the details about who your daughter was and the circumstances.
Okay.
Your caravan, do you kind of set your sights on, because I know you have a professional job as well, just like we all do, and then we do these other things on the side, but
right.
Do you pick a region? I have a few things on the side, as you know, but do you pick a region of the country to target, so to speak, and then you map out the cities that you want to go to, and then you contact police and other families, or you try to get the newspaper articles to connect with other families? How does this, since you are the creator of this kind of a caravan, how does this work?
Well, initially it was generally just to get her story out there. But after about 2 years, what it did start to be was, because I was learning more and more, it started being regionally. It started being, back then it was 16 states took DNA at arrest. So it was initially to all states, how many states I could cover. But I soon started focusing more on the states, especially that hadn't taken DNA at arrest, or back when I first started, Kentucky didn't even have a taking it conviction. So that was one focus of it. And then it was basically trying to get the story in every state. So it was probably a combination of both of those. And what's worked best, I tried initially to pre-plan it, send out emails way before I ever went out, and that really never brought in a lot of coverage. So I started just deciding, I knew the path I would take, and I would email and sometimes call the media first in whatever state I was going to be in the next day. And that was usually at least 30 emails to various media and newspaper. And then when I got in the city, I'd be contacting the police, because often that would be a joint thing, because the media, of course, you know, would want to have something that would even bring it more home. So, I would do that. If I knew, I wasn't always traveling when legislators were, you know, in session, but if there was, you know, a few times I've been able to go, like in North Carolina about 5 years ago in Albany. But it's a lot of it. Sometimes it changes. Like I was just out, I took about 3 weeks to go from Oklahoma all the way out to San Diego and back, and some reporter called me from Las Vegas. So I will change my direction sometimes to get a story out, because the story is so important, all aspects of it. So does that explain it a little bit?
Yes, yeah, it does. And if for people that don't have the benefit of seeing, although we have a lot of postings, or you have like an SUV, is it an SUV or a station wagon?
Yes.
And it's colored.
It's actually the third generation wrap. I started a company called Midwest Wraps in Tulsa. We connected, and they've donated three wraps to the three cars that I've driven up to. You know, I've just basically run them in. So, but it is this current one. It's a Nissan Rogue, and they now have computer programs where they've taken the pictures I gave them, the different, we have a profile on the front hood, and it's wrapped after it's printed on this vinyl. The whole car is wrapped in vinyl, and it has Caravan to Catch a Killer on the side, because I wanted something, even if people were passing me on the highway, that if they saw, they could go search after it. And I've found people where, like I was in Maine and somebody wrote, I passed you on Highway 1 and saw that and did a search. And so, you know, part of it is my daughter's pictures to pull people in, and then part of it is getting information so people can search it out more. And it just brings people up to the car, which is why I go into the city centers, because at lunch or other times or after a story's been, a lot more people come up to the car, and I'm able to give them pamphlets about her murder, about DNA and all those things.
Yeah. Well, we want to be sure to mention this a couple times too. And how do you pay for this venture? How do you fund it?
I work.
You, okay.
I mean, basically, I do. I mean, you know, you take
donations too, correct?
I do. You know, a lot of times because of work and stuff, I just haven't had a lot of time for fundraising. And, you know, I have people all across the U.S., but locally, you know, there's not a lot of people connected to this. So, you know, every once in a while we've done some fundraising and that's helped. But mostly, you know, I work so I can do this. And I love
my
work too.
Well, is there a vehicle by which people can donate to you, to your cause, if they're listening to this show and they can send a donation? We want to mention that a couple times.
Right. We've had two GoFundMe and Plum funds, and they just recently ended, so I'm going to be redoing that. But they can also contact me on our website, which I think you have the address. It's just brittanyphillipsmurder.net, and there's a contact form, and I can tell them where they can also donate. But I'm going to be putting up the next Plum Fund again, because I'm hoping to go out in November for a full month if I can.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Maggie, you
just
go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but before we get too much further into the show, you know, just in case there may be some producers or people listening to this that may be able to do something and help you down the road, can you briefly go into your daughter? I want to know about Brittany, and, you know, what kind of a young lady was she? What were her hopes, dreams, and aspirations? And what ultimately happened? What came to this point?
Great minds think alike. Yeah, Brittany, you know, was, of course, I'm a prejudiced mom, but, you know, she was an unbelievable, beautiful young woman. She had gone away to college on a full ride chemistry scholarship, and came back home because she was a year younger than everybody. But prior to that, you know, in school, a lot of people called me after she died and said, you know, she was never part of a group, but she was always friendly to me. You know, she always seemed to make time for everybody. She was about 5'1" and accused me of making her short, but, you know, she had these long blonde curls and these deep set black eyes but they look black, you know, that just drew people in to talk to her all the time. And she was silly. And when she was at college, you know, she would always tell me her friends, you know, were just shocked that she could be so open with me about stuff. And she did. She would always talk about her feelings and her fears and stuff. And, you know, we had a conversation right before she was murdered where she was just upset about some medical stuff. And, you know, she just would get like a little girl when she was upset. And, you know, she always called me mom, except when she was upset. And then she called me mommy. And her last words that she said to me that night that we talked were, "I love you, mommy." You know, so I have this memory of this little girl, young woman, you know, because she was 18 then, you know, talking to me in that way. And she was going to work in cancer. What she didn't know is I lost my mom 8 months after her to thyroid cancer. And, you know, if she had been alive, she probably would have made that her focus. I mean, because she was so compassionate, you know. She was only, oh gosh, how old was she? 10 when the Oklahoma City bombing happened. And I was the first responder, and she wanted to go with me. And she did one day when I was working the helpline. I mean, even at 10, you know, and she was a dancer. She was just a beautiful, vivacious young woman. And, you know, people, she would stop traffic because she really I say she had a mixture of my looks and her dad's looks, and together it made her really beautiful, even though I divorced her dad when she was four. But, you know, I mean, she just had this little round angel face. And, you know, what happened was I had talked to her that Monday night on the 27th, I think it was, of September 2004. She was having allergy problems. So I said, well, I'll get you a doctor's appointment and we'll get together this weekend, because I lived about 50 miles away from her. And so I called her that Tuesday and I was going to tell her I thought I might have a doctor's appointment. She didn't answer. I called her Wednesday. She didn't answer. But she was, once she was home, she was going to her junior college to get some extra courses. And so I didn't think anything. I just thought, oh, she's out late. And then Thursday night, I called her with that typical mom call of, Brittany, just call me. I know you're okay, but just please call me. And it was 1 a.m. on October 1st that somebody knocked up my door in Chandler and just very quickly said to me, like I said earlier, you need to call Tulsa police. Your daughter's been murdered. And when I got down to Tulsa, I discovered what happened, but I discovered what happened by the detective telling me, not because she was there or anything, because they had ID'd her by her license and they'd already taken her away, but she had been raped and suffocated sometime between, I guess, 9 p.m. that Monday night after I talked to her and 8 a.m. the next morning. And so she had been dead for 3 days, all those days I was calling, she was laying dead there, and they said she did die automatically, you know, so because when they first told me that, I thought, oh my God, you know, what if she was calling mommy, you know.
Oh, that's just so incredible. I know of somebody else, an elderly lady that died in the same manner, and I just can't imagine that someone would be there, and that must go through your mind, like, you know, if only, right? Was it true that in some of my readings that I did, somebody actually went like to the second floor and broke in through like a second story porch through French doors or something, and that's how the person might have gotten in?
We're not sure. There didn't seem to be any evidence of the door being broken in, even, and Brittany was pretty good about locking her doors, you know, because I'm a trauma psychologist. She learned early, but the screens were all off, so they thought maybe he could have come through the window. But I was sitting there cleaning up one day, and it was the first time I ever thought I need to ask Brittany this, because I was looking at the slats on the window of the French doors up there, and it looked like one was out of place. And I thought immediately, I'll have to ask Brittany if that was out of place. And it was, you know, we all, anybody surviving homicide, for a while you do that. You're thinking, oh, maybe I can ask them this, and then you realize you can't. So, you know, it was a second story. That what I also knew was that Brittany had locked herself out one time, and she told me a friend of hers shimmied himself up on the porch and was able to, you know, sort of pull that open to get her in. Of course, we DNA swabbed that guy, and it wasn't him. The fact is we had, there was a couple of profiles of DNA that were found there, but we have DNA from both blood and semen from the same person. So if we ever get a match, that's going to be almost 99% probably her killer, because from two different sources, it's the same person.
It's the same. It seems like you're so close, but yet, so far, in a way, because how many samples was it? Something like 3,000 in the Tulsa area had been run?
Yeah, and it's in sort of Tulsa, Kansas, you know, where the police have more. We've probably run about 3,000 comparisons from sex crimes, from all the male friends she knew, all her old boyfriends, from people down at the school in Florida, from the junior college there. Any crimes that happened around, because they say it usually, you know, somebody lives 5 miles within the radius, it's somebody they know. She's not fitting any of the typical profiles. So, but the scarier thing is that I work closely with OSBI, which is the Oklahoma Bureau, And mm-hmm. from what the head of forensics there, who I'm very close with, tells me, is probably by now it's been run against a million profiles because the samples aren't in CODIS, but the national database, it's been run at least a million times. And that's criminal, that you can't find a match because he's probably serial is what they're thinking. We don't know, but.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. He's probably what?
Serial. They think serial if he's
killer.
Not dead, he's probably serial. If it was somebody who accidentally did it, the general consensus is they feel that the guilt would show. But sexual crimes by people who are hardwired that way, that it's the one crime that doesn't get talked about a lot in the prison system or to friends. And serial killers too tend to, or rapists tend to move along highways, which bringing back to the loop of my caravans is another reason I especially do border states, because I've learned from detectives all across the U.S. that a lot of these people will travel and then get stuck at the border or think they can hide out. And I once was in Montana and they found somebody who was the killer, somebody in Oklahoma, while I was there, which was very weird. So.
Wow. Well, now that you bring up the issue of DNA and how Oklahoma seems to be one of the states in the forefront, there are a lot of people who kind of do not agree with the position that we should be swabbing for DNA upon arrest. Many, many states have it upon conviction. Can you kind of go through this scenario so that people understand what used to be and how it has evolved up until this point?
Yes, I can. And what I first want to say is before this happened, I was really naive about DNA, and I believed a lot of things which I hear as an argument, and it was only through educating myself through a lot of scientific websites, through talking with a lot of district attorneys, through talking with a lot of bureaus that I've learned, and I was surprised at how wrong I was about the belief. Right now we have 29, I think we may have gotten state 30, that all take DNA at some form of arrest. Initially, it started out where I forget how many years ago, only states were taking it at conviction. But that initially was a hard fight too. And then about 6 years ago, I think Kentucky was finally the last state to finally take it at conviction. When I started doing the caravans, I think we had 15 states. And like I said, now we have 29.
Article I read said 32, but I don't know if that's right.
Well, there's a couple that, like ours, Oklahoma, and it depends who you read, because Oklahoma passed it after 8 years. I mean, that I fought for 8 years to get them to pass it, but they haven't funded it this past year, and so now we're fighting that. So it's for one or two of the sites, they only talk about the funded ones, and then
right.
Florida, I think they're finally getting theirs fully implemented, but when they had it in 2009, maybe, they mm-hmm. had a 10-year plan of getting it implemented. So the number's a little bit deceptive, and it's still a problem why we still need more, but I'm not sure how you want me to go about this, but, the DNA swab, a couple of things. People, one, think their DNA is floating around out there. When the DNA is taken, a swab that just, it's a Q-tip in the cheek, it's analyzed in very secure areas, and all they do is, we have thousands of pieces of DNA in our body. They chose, 30 years ago, they chose 14 pieces, 13 which have basically, they're like spacers in our body, and they don't have any of the medical issues, color of hair, anything like that. They're just specific to that person, and then they say whether there's male or female. And when they pull those out, which takes time, that is then coded into a numerical statement that represents that DNA sample. That's what's compared to other DNA samples. That's what goes up into CODIS. It's a series of numbers and identifiers, not the the sample. The sample is kept.
So it would be like assigning a social security number or something, right?
Even the DNA name is social security. Yeah, and even the name, you know, and then but then there's some people who have issues with numbers, but the name isn't even identified. In CODIS, let's say Tom Jones was his, he'd be number 58573, and then his profile would be attached to that. And so then it, if there was a match in CODIS, they'd say, okay, 5753 matched 4321, you know, and you know, so, I mean, it's very protected. You know, they have even the machines that analyze it and where it's stored. Like in Oklahoma, it's very typical. There's a time that the machines do the self-cleaning, and everything's on such a schedule. If anybody ever broke the schedule, you know, it would be detected. But the thing is, nothing can be done with the DNA. Now, that being said, when you have a blood sample at the doctor's office, when you do a swab to identify your child, people sending off their samples to 23andMe or different things, or things like that, you know, those samples are very less protected. And, you know, insurance companies could, you know, have people, you know, it's just, it's a very protected system. It's not invasive. And there's been at least five court, state Supreme Court cases that ruled is, that DNA is just a digital fingerprint, that it doesn't invade privacy. And one of the main things with the Fourth Amendment, and it took a while for me to learn this, is that you have, you know, that it's unreasonable search and seizure. Well, when a person is arrested, you have to arrest a person with probable cause.
Right.
And you can't arrest them or that whole arrest gets thrown out if you don't have probable cause. And they used to argue this about fingerprints. Well, we can't take the fingerprint. And then what finally won it over after all these years, you know, because we've been doing fingerprints forever, was that if you have probable cause, that and I worked in the prison system 10 years, I can tell you when somebody's arrested, everything is searched. The DNA sample is the least invasive thing that happens to them, because when people are arrested, they want to make sure they're not bringing anything in. And so this isn't invasive in any ways. And
invasive whatsoever.
And along with the five, Supreme Courts in the states that said, because the major one that finally went, the more recent one, was King versus Maryland, and that went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled that it wasn't an invasion of privacy, that it was no different than fingerprints. All it is that it's a more accurate, because fingerprints are about 86% or something accurate, and the DNA is 99, I may have the 0.5 or whatever. I mean, it's very hard to do anything with it. That being said, one of the most important things is you can have a match on your DNA, like we may get a match, but if we don't have any other evidence, we don't have a case, because you can't just convict with DNA. So when people argue, oh, it's going to be, you know, false imprisonment, actually we're beginning to work with the Innocence Project. And whereas the Innocence Project is using the DNA to get them out after 15 years,
right,
DNA can help prevent these false imprisonments, because usually you hear, oh yeah, that guy was in prison for 20 years and then they found that his DNA did not match.
That DNA didn't match. So,
yeah.
Oh, it has so many benefits, Maggie. I just can't believe it. What would you, in all of these years, you must have sort of polished your, I don't want to say spiel, but your comeback to, say for example, if I'm a legislator, and you pull into my town and you happen to be able to meet with them, what what is most important to them? What would be your response to them when they start to balk about this? Or, you know, so how would you address the legislator, and then how would you address someone from the media? How would it be different in terms of this issue?
Right, and that's a great question. You know, I mean, one thing I've learned in, because I spent 8 years, I don't know how I did it, you know, staying up at the Capitol, but I really had to learn to speak the language of the lawmakers, you know, and for anybody who's advocating anything, understanding the language of the people that you're trying to influence is most important and stuff. And so part of it is, you know, wanting, if they're, you know, if they're pro-community, then they want to lessen crime. So I will always talk about, I bring in studies from Maryland and from Indiana and Denver and Washington State, and Denver and Indiana especially did these crime studies that show, and I'm not being accurate in the percentage exactly, but, you know, it brings cold cases down to one third of what they are. In Denver, they've done all these burglary studies because they say one burglar usually has 221 burglaries associated with them. It brings down the cost of the cold cases and the multiple arrests and stuff. So I really try to bring in those studies to the lawmakers and show how it cuts down on crime, how it, Denver and Tennessee now, I mean, Colorado and Tennessee are talking about how they are actually, I wouldn't say, they're making money because they're not losing money on man hours and stuff. You know, they have much less of a deficit. You know, and I bring it home to family because one of the things I think we have with lawmakers is it's still this sort of old-fashioned belief that somehow the victim causes, and I'm sure you both understand that, you know, where we still blame the victim sometimes. So I try to help them understand that, you know, this happens to anybody. I'm a psychologist. Brittany was a, you know, chemistry major and stuff. And it's not just people who are putting themselves in danger. And the only way that we're going to stop this risk is getting these predator criminals off the street early in their careers and showing. I have timelines where I show the lawmakers where this person was first arrested and how 20 years or 15 years or 10 years later, how many crimes happened before he or she was convicted, you know, and how that DNA would have stopped, you know, those two murders and those three assaults and all that. So a lot of it is more factual, but also, I mean, I had a lawmaker who stood on the floor of the Senate in Oklahoma and said, this is not something that our military is fighting for. Again, a myth that he didn't understand, and I think he, for many reasons, he changed his vote. But I work with vets and soldiers, and I have for about 8 years. And what I know is every single service member gives their DNA when they enlist. So if their bodies are blown up or if they are killed, that their families at least get something sent home, you know. And so, you know, a lot of times it's not necessarily adamant, you know, being against it, it's that nobody's questioned some of the myths like invasion of privacy or that the DNA is going to be floating out there. You know, for some people, it's just educating. And, you know, in the city with the, when I'm doing media stories, it's still some of the same things, but I try to bring it home as, you know, Brittany's just the girl next door. I never expected that this would be my life, you know, and none of us do when we have a kids. We think, what if, and we go, no, can't think about that. And, you know, so I try to bring it home that I don't want anybody else to go through this never ending loss that I will never, ever fully get rid of. But I can lessen it if I can help people understand, you know, this could be your daughter. I mean, I really try to bring it home in a very personal level.
In a personal way, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Because that, it, but people don't want to think, don't want to go there. Oh, no, it can't be my family. And that's the hard sell, too. Now, if you encounter someone from the media, are they sort of carrying around those same falsehoods, or is it a different – different approach that you may use with them, because those are the people you're trying to attract now. What should they know? I mean, they should know the same information you just told us about the lawmakers, but their focus is different.
Right, their focus is different, but part of it is I know each city I'm going into, so I'm going to have aspects of that city. I try to bring it home to that city. I will try to bring up families or people maybe that I haven't even met, but, you know, crimes that I know have a similar history, because, you know, they want to know how it relates to, you know, their city and stuff. And
the area they're covering, right.
And I often also, I mean, you know, I don't know if this is good or bad, but, I mean, over these years, I've had to sort of look at it as a science of what do I need to do. Same way I came up with the idea of the caravan. How do I get my story beyond Oklahoma? So, you know, I have to look at the reporters. I will investigate each of their histories. I read their bios. And I'm going to try to find somebody who is a crime reporter or who's an investigative reporter. Because if I can get them, often, you know, like you all, you're so passionate. So doing a story with you is going to give it this extra oomph, you know.
Yeah, it's half the battle.
Yeah, it is.
Well, Maggie, if playing devil's advocate, not necessarily so, because we don't know who's going to listen to this show, either who is listening in live right now or later. But if there is a producer or a reporter or someone nationally that can give this story some dynamite, speak to them, what would you want to say?
Well, that, you know, even if they don't believe that what I'm saying is, you know, strong facts or whatever, have the discussion with me, because the discussion, you know, it could educate me on something. Probably not about the DNA, you know, but I didn't understand a lot of this, and I think I can help, you know, help others to understand it. But also that, you know, the more information that we can get out, the more lives we're going to save, because I have met thousands of families, and, you know, even getting this story out nationally to know that somebody with, you know, a basic murder, you know, that the stories can be told. I mean, there's so many aspects to this, you know, educating to save lives, that, you know, that we all deserve a voice to the story. You know, that whatever their angle is, even if they're against what I'm saying, then bring me on to have the discussion with them and let people decide for themselves. I mean, that's always what I said to the lawmakers, to the media, the people I meet, you know, get the facts and then make your decisions. And facts are just, we went from not passing the bill three times to this last time really just doing real strong education. We had FOP, the Federation of Police, helping us, but we really sat in every single lawmaker's office and we changed 15 votes, you know, so.
That's significant.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But again, even if you don't believe in what I'm saying, then be a true newsmaker and be willing
and present both sides.
Yeah, because I had a head of a committee for 2 years, and he was Speaker of our Senate, and he would not even bring the bill up to the committee. And I went to him, and I went to a meeting. I said, is this a true democratic society where you're not even bringing it up to the other lawmakers to allow them to vote on it? And so, you know, if it loses because the committee disagrees, that's fine, but at least let the committee. So even if I don't change their mind, allow me to, you know, speak
to educate them
to
the other side of things.
Exactly.
Right. That's what a free society is supposed to be about. So, you know, and it's hard. It's hard work. I've presented a couple bills in our legislature, and it is about money too. My understanding is a few years ago it cost about, in order to bring up a bill and to pass it in our state, it cost about $6,000 or something like that. But this could save so much money, could save so many lives. I mean, like you said, you are preaching to the choir here, but I just think it could do so much good. But
right.
I did want to ask you a couple other related questions, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I know initially before, you know, you were focusing on the DNA, I had read where your maybe what you first started to do was build this bridge in your daughter's name in terms of the, I don't know what the first part was, but the second part was being able to train first responders. And did that have to do with how they do death notification?
Oh, it had to do with a lot of things. Yeah, it did. Well, and you know, it's interesting because I'm not so unique. I mean, that which didn't kill us made us stronger, but
right.
You know, it's in wanting to protect again other families, that notification was horrific. I was in a little town, and luckily they had notified my son, who was in Tulsa, with a chaplain and the police officer. This was some young sheriff, and of course I was very upset about it, but I ended up going to the chief of police in that town and talking to him, and I've done trainings, you know, around with different the departments, with the Tulsa police, with their training academy, with OSBI. And I often will talk about it to police chiefs. You know, I think people are much better, but that was one. Two, like I said, when I went down there and my daughter was already taken, and then I wasn't allowed to ever see her. And even the funeral director said, well, she's been autopsied. You don't want to see her. And so I had to say goodbye by running my finger over her nose, which was covered by a blanket. You know, they wouldn't even let me. So those things, you know, also training funeral directors and stuff. And I've worked a lot with OSBI in Oklahoma, trying to talk to them because, you know, kindness and protective. But, you know, I had the director of OSBI say to me, well, we don't want to, you know, show the family pictures or shock them or anything. And I said, you know, we're already shocked when we get those first words. You've got to allow the family those decisions, whether to see the body or not, because so many people, I don't have it, but so many people all across the U.S., anywhere, for some people, they will think, if I don't have closure of seeing the body, if I don't have certain things done, then I'll never get better. And I know that's not true, but I just want to try.
But emotionally, you wanted to tactfully say goodbye, you know, maybe rub her hair.
Yeah, I mean, I would have liked to.
Yeah.
But I mean, but I, the way I dealt with it was I taught people not to do that anymore. But I do know that a lot of people in their healing process can be devastated, and it's like secondary trauma to have something like that happen. And even though I was able to work through it, not everybody could. And so I want to try to find as many corners. I mean, I was just doing a panel in Connecticut, and a woman who lost two children at different times, and the way that she learned about the second murder was through the media. So, you know, I've had friends who have lost and missing, and they find out about it on the media before. So there's so many avenues that we can educate. And it's not that people do it meanly. It's just we don't think about the further impact of all of these things. So I don't know if that helps. You know,
yeah,
I'm not
well,
sure what a producer would want.
Well, I think it's all about telling a human story, and particularly like what we said prior to the show, that there are so many unsolved homicides and so many stories to tell, and they're always looking for human stories, although they tend to gravitate to the most sensational aspects, and they always talk about the perpetrator versus the victim, which just, you know, enrages me because we never get we never get the equal time, Maggie. You know, it's out. We're always fighting against that tide because you hear everything, and you're lucky if you're even your victim gets mentioned at all.
Well,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, sorry, I don't really purposely do this, but looping back to the DNA, one of the big things that a lot of us have been saying is taking DNA. You know, you argue that it invades the privacy, which it doesn't. But what about the privacy of the thousands of the victims who could have been saved if we took the DNA? You know, and so, you know, so many victims. I mean, again, even in that set, in the DNA fight, we talk more about the perpetrator than the victim.
Right. And with on that same line, is it not true that I read that should the person whose DNA was taken and it proves that they're not convicted, not arrested, and they close the case, then all of that is destroyed and there is no record of that. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, you have to have it in the law, but like we have an expungement clause in ours, you know, and that helps focus it. But yeah, some states will automatically expunge it. Some states charge to expunge it. It's a wide variety, but yeah, and nothing can be done with it. That's the whole. I wish I could help people understand that, you know, whether it's destroyed or not, nothing can be done with it. There's nothing you could do with the DNA sample. I mean, even if somebody could ever obtain it, which it's like San Quentin prison on being able to ever get into where the DNA samples are stored. But I mean, there's nothing that can be done with it. So.
Well, see, and I think that's one fact that people don't know as well. And another thing that I was wondering about, because I own a second property in South Carolina, and I will be retiring to that property one of these days. And I just wonder, like with getting renters, I think I had read whereby there had been other crimes in the area prior to your daughter renting this apartment, correct?
Yep.
And nothing was revealed. And I tried to look up even today what, you know, I work for an agency that deals with people with disabilities, and we have volunteer services department, and we're very strict about getting volunteers. They have to use the state police and doing a criminal background check for people to be a volunteer to work with people who are blind and visually impaired. And yet you can rent your condo or your apartment to any Tom, Dick, or Harry that could be potentially a Ted Bundy. And I guess, you know, that's discrimination. Is that the crux of the matter with this? I mean, why is it that they just do financial checks on people like that and not criminal checks?
Well,
there's
multiple. Well, you know, the thing I always say is how can we understand irrational behavior? But, you know, because it's irrational. There's no understanding of it. But, yeah, I mean, you know, the problem, too, is that if you can look on police reports, you know, on every police state website, you know, it can show you the crimes in the area. That's if they're reported. There's no law specifically that I know of, at least none in our state, where the apartment owners have to identify if other crimes have happened. And that was the problem with us, is that we found somebody had broken into her apartment before she lived there. Somebody had also broken into and attempted to attack another girl in the next building down. And we only found out about this after her murder. And when I talked to the apartment manager, she said, we didn't have to tell you anything. You know, and then they kicked me off for putting posters. They wouldn't let me put posters around the apartment complex. You know, and we still look at people there. But yeah, I mean, there's people even in home ownership. I know there's been problems where people have been killed in a home, and it doesn't have to be publicized. But the background checks, you know, the strange thing is they did a background check on my daughter But some, like you said, somebody can sublet it. Somebody can have other people living in there. Security is a problem. You know, a lot of the complexes, like where she lived, they have one security person that goes around to five different complexes.
Right. How can you possibly monitor correctly?
Yeah.
Right.
And the sad
right.
thing is, she went to the high school right next door to it for 4 years. We never heard about anything bad in those apartments till after. You know, they just,
really?
You know, it's just crazy.
Well, I understand if someone has a record of conviction and maybe they've paid their debt to society, but if they're, you know, if there's something on the record and there's, you know, I think just from a humanitarian standpoint that people should be informed. Now, on the other side of it, maybe the property managers think, well, I would never get this rented if we divulged XYZ, which is, I guess, a good point, but I think homicide is a priority over having an apartment rented. I'm sorry.
And you know, I agree too. And the sad thing. Well, let me put it this way: that same apartment complex, because I constantly go in there to look at it when I would, you know, come down during the weekend and stuff. And one day I saw a young girl and I guess her father moving in a couch, and she had a little baby. And she said, "Oh, are you looking to move in there?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Oh, I'm moving in here." I said, "Oh, so did they inform you that there was a murder upstairs right above you?" And she said, "No." And supposedly, I said, "Well, tell them you know that, and you probably are more than welcome to break the contract on that." I mean, they hadn't even told this young mother with a little newborn, or not newborn, but young.
Well,
you know, I mean.
Right. I understand that, you know, I would want to know too and think twice, but I don't know how we conquer something like that, because, you know, supposedly, you know, we can't show favoritism for anybody that rents. But in any case, I'm never going to understand that one. Was there a reason why you chose? I mean, you only had a limited choice in terms of when your daughter was going to be buried. It was a sake of like 3 days, because she had, you know, she had already been there for like 3 days. And you happened to choose her birthday. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was a hard decision, but, you know, she was killed on that Monday. The autopsy was not done completed till Saturday afternoon. And so I had a choice to, you know, bury her a day before, because once she was found, you know, then we started setting up things a day before, a day after. But I said, you know, it's always going to be right at her birthday, so why not honor her on that
day? Honor her
day?
By having it on. Wow, that must have taken a lot of strength to do that. What are your, I mean, I know that you're very focused in doing this particular endeavor, but do you see yourself doing something different down the road? Are you going to keep doing the cat caravan for as long as you are physically, emotionally, financially able?
Well, you know, emotionally, I'll always be able. Physically, you know, that's the question. That'll decide it on their own. And financially, I mean, I'm just going to keep doing it, because, you know, even now I accept I may not find her murderer, but I'm never going to stop trying. And every single time I go out on the road, I get tips, or either I or the police get tips. So, you know, it's just one more thing that gets ruled out. And, you know, there's, I don't know how many people I've talked to, she said, "That's not what I understood about DNA." So I feel like it may not be the movement, but I'm going to continue to educate people, because every person is educated. We get closer to saving lives. You know, I mean, some people talk to me about going into politics, but I don't think I want to do that.
Well, you're educating people one at a time. And
yes.
And that's the beauty of it, you know, and I just commend you so much, and I respect what you're doing, and And, you know, your perseverance in this is just incredible. And I really do hope that producers and journalists and other writers and everybody else will listen to the show. And please do take this and utilize it to your best purpose. And I hope that we have made a good connection here and that we will keep in touch as well, too. So if we can do anything else to assist you in this endeavor, you have my help.
Well, you all are just unbelievable, and you will always have a place in my heart. That is, and Delilah already knows that, but since I just met you, you need to know that now, too.
Well, we thank you so much, and we wish you all the best, and I think you are making inroads incredibly, and it only takes that one person to help you go national, so I hope they will listen to this show. And are you returning back to Tulsa now soon? Is it tomorrow? Or
no, I'm actually going to try to hit – I'm in Albany now. I'm going to try to get some stories here. I'm going to try to cover New York and Indiana and possibly one more state that doesn't have DNA, and just try to stay out till get home maybe Monday and stuff.
Very good. Well, please do keep in touch. Keep us updated, and we'll be sure to keep you on our social media. Okay, Maggie?
Thank you so much. I mean, this is a true, true gift.
Well, it's been wonderful. So I guess we will be closing out this special edition of Shattered Life Radio. Thank you, Maggie. Godspeed on your travels. Delilah, thank you so much for taking time out to do this special show. And we will see you on the next edition of Shattered Life Radio on the next Saturday to follow. Bye-bye.